The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the National Geographic Traveler and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Now, in recognition of February as Black History Month, our journey on today's Armchair Traveler focuses on two prominent parts of what is now known as the U.S. Civil Rights Trail. Writer Ken Woodley of the Washington Post starts our journey with New U.S. Civil Rights Trail Leads to Little-Known Virginia Museum, his article from the August 10, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. It lacks the renown of Philadelphia's Independence Hall, but Robert Russa Moton High School in Prince Edward County, Virginia, played a seminal role in the course of America's human events. And now the site is getting its due as part of the U.S. Civil Rights Trail launched this year, and that refers, of course, to 2018. The trail comprises more than 100 locations in 14 states. Some are well-known, such as the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, where law enforcement officers beat civil rights marchers in 1965 on what became known as Bloody Sunday. Others are practically unknown, such as Moton High. Even many Virginians are unaware of its importance. The trail offers a timeline of significant dates in the civil rights movement. The student walkout at Moton High, which happened 4 years before Rosa Parks refused to yield her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, is listed first. A lot of folks are coming to realize that you can't tell the civil rights story of this country without starting with what happened here, said Cameron Patterson, managing director of the Robert Russa Moton Museum, which is now housed in the former high school in Farmville, a small town of 8,000 residents in central Virginia. As a reporter, then editor of the Farmville Herald from 1979 to 2015, and author of an upcoming book about race relations in the county, I agree. The walkout had far-reaching consequences both locally and nationally. On April 23, 1951, 16-year-old Barbara Rose Johns led the student body at Moton High, a segregated all-black school, into direct nonviolent protest against the separatist stance of Jim Crow. Their two-week strike was a defiant public stand against the separate and clearly unequal conditions at the overcrowded school, which included auxiliary classrooms that were little more than tar paper shacks. The strike was John's idea, and she enlisted a few trusted student leaders, including John Arthur Stokes and John Watson, for the meticulous, highly clandestine planning necessary to carry it out. The undertaking was so secretive that John's 13-year-old younger sister was caught by surprise when she watched John's announce the strike from the stage in the Moton High Auditorium. "Never in my wildest dreams," Joan Johns Cobbs said, "could she have imagined the building becoming a museum." Initially, Johns and her classmates wanted a new school equal in quality to the white school a few blocks away. After consulting with NAACP attorneys Oliver Hill and Spotswood Robison III, however, the students and their families decided to seek more than a separate but equal status. They filed suit to end school segregation. Davis v. School Board of Prince Edward County, named for ninth grade striker Dorothy Davis, became one of five cases combined as Brown v. Board of Education. Moton High became, as the museum puts it, the student birthplace of the Civil Rights Revolution, and Farmville, the seat of Prince Edward County, would become ground zero for the fiercest and most prolonged resistance to school desegregation. 3 years after the walkout, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the landmark Brown case in the plaintiff's favor, but the fight wasn't over. Virginia adopted a policy known as massive resistance, and approximately a dozen schools in three localities were closed in the fall of 1958. When Virginia reversed course in February 1959, three schools reopened, but Prince Edward County's Board of Supervisors voted in June 1959 to completely shut down their public schools rather than and integrate. Most white students were educated in a private academy while black students were left on their own. The public schools didn't reopen until 5 years later, after the U.S. Supreme Court's 1964 decision in Griffin versus County School Board of Prince Edward County, which affirmed the constitutional right of every American child to a public education. Johns and her classmates offered a powerful example of young people pointing the way to challenging adults to simply live up to their own words, Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat of Virginia, wrote in an email. The students, who were asked to say the Pledge of Allegiance every day, would not accept a platitudinous incantation of liberty and justice for all without questioning the unwillingness of their society to make good on the promise, he said. Bo Dickinson, social studies supervisor for Rockingham County, Virginia schools, considered it to be a powerful lesson for high school students in particular because it demonstrates that even teenagers can leave their mark on history. Students from Rockingham make the two-hour journey to Farmville every April for the unique opportunity to experience Virginia's civil rights history within the actual walls where these pivotal events unfolded, Dickinson said. The building that became a National Historic Landmark had seemed fated for demolition in the mid-1990s when the Prince Edward County Board of Supervisors appeared prepared to sell the property to a developer. But public opposition emerged, and the Martha E. Forrester Council of Women launched an ultimately successful campaign to purchase the building and turn it into a museum. The museum, which opened in 2001, averages 10,000 visitors annually. Its six galleries tell the story from the Johns led student strike through the Brown decision and massive resistance to the rebirth of public schools in the community. The Trail's interactive website provides information about the museum and the statue honoring Johns on the grounds of the state capitol in Richmond, as well as a wealth of other resources to help followers understand the fight for civil rights. The old adage is true, said U.S. Civil Rights Trail Chairman Lee Sentell, who is also director of the Alabama Tourism Department. We must know our history if we are not to repeat the mistakes of the past, he noted. Prince Edward County seems determined not to repeat those mistakes. In 2008, its multiracial board of supervisors installed a light dedicated to Johns and the students, which shines in the tower atop the same courthouse in which their counterparts voted to shut down public education. On its marker, the county expresses regret for the pain it caused and the lost opportunities and dreams. And last year, the Farmville Town Council renamed the community's public library in honor of Johns, who married the Reverend William Powell, had five children, and became a librarian in Philadelphia's public schools. She died in 1991. Cobb said her late sister would be shocked but pleased by these developments. While the light brings back painful memories, at the same time, it reminds me, she said, of the fact that there are people of goodwill who seek to heal the community by their actions. So I feel a sense of peace when I see the light. The county, which is 64% white and 32% black, according to 2015 Census Bureau data, has changed in other ways since shutting its doors to black students 59 years ago. It gave President Barack Obama a majority of its votes in 2008 and 2012, and did the same for Hillary Clinton in 2016, one of just a handful of blue jurisdictions in a sea of red. The museum is prominently featured on the community's online tourism hub, Visit Farmville.com. And again, that website is visitfarmville.com. Other local attractions include the 31-mile-long High Bridge Trail State Park, which is popular with hikers, joggers, cyclists, and horseback riders, and the 4-mile Farmville Blue Way Paddle Trail, which attracts canoeists and kayakers. Its inclusion on the U.S. Civil Rights Trail is being greeted enthusiastically by black and white residents alike. Scott M. Harwood, Sr. had finished his sophomore year in high school when the public schools closed and would go on to graduate from the private all-white Prince Edward Academy, now closed. It's fantastic that the museum is now on the U.S. Civil Rights Trail, he said. I've always thought it was a hidden jewel. It has the fairest, most well-balanced storytelling that I've seen. A member of the Academy's first graduating class, Gene Watson, said the museum is something we're proud of. It's a real plus for the community. Patty Cooper Jones, the first African-American woman to chair the Prince Edward County Board of Supervisors, shares their pride in the museum, and she said that she sees the trail as more than a tool for tourism. Its most important impact will be on the education of a whole new generation of Americans on the struggle to provide equal rights, she said. With the increased polarization in America, this trail and the story it tells is especially poignant and needs to be heard by every citizen. Dickinson, the social studies director, is glad the U.S. Civil Rights Trail would lead more visitors to the museum. It is particularly encouraging to see the students of today embrace the difficult stories of previous generations in order to better understand our present circumstances, he said. This fills me with hope that the current generation will bring about a brighter tomorrow. Now, the writer, Ken Woodley, is based in Appomattox County, Virginia, and he has some tips if you'd like to go to Farmville, Virginia for this event. And it's, again, the Robert Russa Moton Museum, and it is 900 Griffin Boulevard, Farmville, Virginia. And you can get more information at motonmuseum.org, M-O-T-O-N, motonmuseum.org, or try civilrightstrail.com, civilrightstrail.com. And then visitors to this National Historic Landmark can view the museum's permanent exhibition, The Moton School Story, Children of Courage, which tells the story from the student strike through massive resistance to the rebirth of public education. They can also visit the auditorium where the strike started. Closed Sundays, and it's open noon until 4 p.m. Monday through Saturday, and by appointment, and it is all free. Well, we're going to feature next writer Glenn Pogue's article, Southern Roots, from the February-March 2019 issue of National Geographic Traveler. And as the editors note, national history and family heritage connect an Alabama road trip to sites on the U.S. Civil Rights Trail. So essentially, we're going from Virginia to Alabama now as we continue. The lemonade ain't ready yet, sweetie, said the cashier. We got sweet tea, though. It's 11 a.m. at Eagle's Restaurant in Birmingham, Alabama. I can see women in the kitchen squeezing the juice out of bright yellow lemons into giant plastic vats. This wasn't going to be some country time powdered mix. It was going to be fresh. A soul food joint just off I-65 in the northern part of the city, Eagles has been black-owned and family-operated since it opened its doors in 1951, 40 years before I was born. On the walls are faded pictures of the athletes and politicians who've dined here. It's early for this buffet of oxtails, black-eyed peas, mac and cheese, collard greens, candied yams, and spaghetti and tomato sauce. But since my dad and I have only just begun our Alabama road trip, the novelty of having soul food for every meal is overpowering. I ordered the sweet tea. My father sits at one of the restaurant's six vinyl booths, eyeglasses lifted onto his forehead, squinting down at a Google map on his phone that traces our path from Birmingham to Selma to Montgomery. I've never been to the Deep South before, but I'm here now to visit historic sites along the recently inaugurated U.S. Civil Rights Trail, a conceptual pathway that links 130 museums, churches, courthouses, and other places that have contributed to the advancement of social equality in this country. The trail includes Topeka, Kansas, the site of the landmark 1954 Brown v. Board of Education case, and Memphis, Tennessee, where, just a few weeks prior to my trip, thousands of people flocked to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s death and to mark the opening of the new National Civil Rights Museum in the Lorraine Hotel where King was assassinated. Nearly a quarter of the trail sites are in Alabama, a place many consider ground zero for the civil rights movement. The trail covers the attacks on freedom riders, the Selma to Montgomery Voting Rights March, and the Montgomery Street corner where Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus to a white man. Birmingham itself was nicknamed Bombingham in the 1950s for the sticks of dynamite set off by racists at the homes of black activists and at public gathering places, including the 16th Street Baptist Church, where four young girls lost their lives. I break a piece of cornbread and watch steam rise from the middle. My family has roots below the Mason-Dixon line, but I'm a diehard Brooklyn girl who spent my adolescent years pretending to be from the Caribbean because that's where most of the black kids in my elementary school were from. They had always teased me that as a black American, I had no culture, and for a while I believed them. It had me questioning early on what it meant to be not just black in America, but to be black and American. I think about that now, sitting here in Eagles, eating food prepared by women who remind me of women in my own family. The food is so clearly of a culture with a specific way to be enjoyed. I know how to bow my head and thank the hands that prepared it before I eat. I know to put hot sauce in the mac and cheese, a little vinegar on the greens. I know that when I'm done, I'll probably need a nap. It's this knowledge that makes the South seem like home to me, despite my geographical distance from the region. I sensed immediately at Eagles an unspoken message. I see you, respect you, affirm you. I'm road tripping with my dad to see if this kind of deep-seated connectedness is something I'll find throughout Alabama. And I'm on a quest to bridge what I have learned about black history and culture with what I can feel of it in a place steeped in the foods, religion, and rich traditions of my people. On our way out of Eagles, the cashier rushes over with a cup of lemonade. "It's on the house, sweetie," she said. I smile. I've just gotten my first taste of Southern hospitality. In Birmingham, we stay at the 14-story Redmont, Alabama's oldest operating hotel. It's all about vaulted ceilings, crystal chandeliers, and doormen who still wear pillbox hats and jackets. Typically, I'd find this charming, but now the period details are a reminder that black, when the Redmont was built in 1925, my father and I wouldn't have been able to get a room. Instead, we would have been directed to the Gaston Motel, one of the numerous businesses owned by A.G. Gaston, an Alabama native who by 1960 was considered the richest black man in America. Bombed once, the Gaston was a meeting joint for civil rights marchers. Room 30, where King stayed, was notably dubbed the War Room, situated near 4th Avenue. The motel anchored this historic black business sector, which saw its height during the civil rights era, but traces its roots to the early 1900s. At that time, locals and those passing through could find places to rest and eat, and maybe get a haircut or a shoe shine. There are plans to rehabilitate the long-shuttered motel as an annex to the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. Little remains of 4th Avenue's vitality. At Green Acres Cafe, one of the last remaining black-owned businesses from the civil rights era, we order fish sandwiches, whiting fried hard, doused in hot sauce and ketchup, between two slices of white bread, just the way I'd had them growing up. We sit on a bench outside to eat. I imagine a 4th Avenue as it once was, black folks shopping, dining, and being enterprising, I am struck by the power in this conjured scene. "You know, black people invented bread and breakfasts, right?" my father says as we drive to Selma, less than 2 hours south of Birmingham. I tilt my head to the side. "For real?" "Well, not exactly. It's just my theory, because we could never stay nowhere. That's what the Green Book was for, so we'd know exactly where to go and not to go. The Negro Motorist Green Book was an annual guide for African-American road trippers published by New York City mailman Victor Hugo Green. The book was made up of personal testimonials from one black traveler to another. Readers could flip through pages of recommended establishments to discover where they could have a warm meal, not just the fried chicken they'd stashed in a shoebox in case the next eatery serving black folks was miles away, or where they could use a real bathroom instead of going by the side of the road or in a pecan. Rest stops were a no-go, as were certain cities after dark. Those were called sundown towns, and the Green Book advised black travelers to drive on. My father and I have spent lots of times together in cars, driving up and down highways and parkways in the Northeast, shuttling groceries and antique furniture to and from five-bed and breakfasts my family operates. The only fight we ever get into is over the radio. I want a hip-hop station. He insists on NPR. While we haven't felt particularly unsafe on the road in Alabama, my father does make a point of putting on his U.S. Navy veteran hat before we go out each day. Only six in 1964, when Jim Crow laws ended in the South, my father experienced the civil rights movement mainly by watching Dr. King give speeches on TV. During the annual road trips, he and his family took to South Carolina to visit relatives. He would see signs declaring, "You are now entering Klan country," and he'd be filled with a fear he didn't understand, because on the East Coast Army bases where he grew up, pecking order was based more on military rank than race. Everyone was cool with everyone, especially the kids, he said, black, white, it didn't matter. As we approach Selma, a small town of around 18,000 people, I shoot a text to Thelma Diane Harris, a 69-year-old Selma native and former student activist in the Voting Rights March. Ms. Harris now offers tours of Selma's civil rights landmarks. I found her on Facebook, and we've been talking over the phone for a few weeks. She had helped me track down a black-owned homestay in town. I meet her on the steps of Brown Chapel AME Church, the starting point for the Selma to Montgomery marches. She's a petite woman with a soft voice and warm smile. Her hair, makeup, and clothes are styled in a careful way that reminds me of every older woman in my family. We hug like best friends. "Welcome to Selma," she says proudly. Throughout our journey, my father keeps saying that the places we're visiting are on hallowed ground. It becomes his mantra. Inside Brown Chapel, we take seats in a wooden pew near the front. The wood is worn down to a softness that makes me think about the bodies that once filled these same seats. What were they feeling when they sat here? Joy? Anger? Mourning? Righteousness? All were possible in the civil rights era, when the church wasn't just a place to go for Sunday service, but a safe space to organize demonstrations and share resources. It's why churches were and are targets of hate groups determined to thwart progress and spread fear. Later that afternoon, Ms. Harris brings us to the Edmund Pettus Bridge. "I remember the day so well," she says. "I was 15. She's referring to March 7, 1965, or Bloody Sunday. That day, some 600 demonstrators attempted to cross the Pettus Bridge on a march from Selma to Montgomery to demand voting rights. The demonstrators' plan was to march to the Capitol building at Montgomery and bring their case directly to Alabama Governor George Wallace. When they got to the bridge, which sits at the edge of Selma city limits, there was a mob, and they started attacking marchers at the front, beating them with bats and pipes. There was tear gas in the air," she tells us. Miss Harris was marching with her brother, and they started running, trailed by a policeman on horseback. All I kept telling myself was, "Just get back to the church, just get back to the church." 14 days later, on March 21st, demonstrators successfully crossed the bridge, arriving in Montgomery on March 25th. Miss Harris was among the 25,000 demonstrators in Montgomery that day. As a young girl, I knew the civil rights movement as names, places, and dates I needed to memorize to pass quizzes during Black History Month. But listening to Miss Harris's stories, this distant history seems suddenly tangible. The next morning, we wake up in the home Miss Harris helped us find. It's a shotgun-style house with a coziness that feels like a families have made memories here. Of all the places we would stay in Alabama, this will be our favorite. Although our host, Mark, isn't physically there, his presence is everywhere. There are little notes on the fridge and cabinets that encourage us to help ourselves to snacks. When we check out, I'll foolishly leave my ID behind, and Mark will priority mail it to my Brooklyn apartment. When I email him to say thank you, he replies with a nod to the world of a Black Panther. That's what we do in Wakanda. We look out for each other. I read online that the old live oak cemetery not too far away is dripping in Spanish moss, and I decide we have to check it out. Driving up the gravel entrance to the cemetery, we see a lot of moss as well as Confederate flags neatly dotting every grave in sight. When the wind blows, they flap in a flurry of red. They seem to me like flags of a foreign country. We discover a headstone for Edmund Pettus, for whom the bridge was named. The stone indicates that he was a general in the Confederacy. Above the inscription is an iron Ku Klux Klan cross. Pettus was a grand dragon of the KKK. As we walk further into the cemetery, we run into a towering statue of a Confederate soldier, north-facing cannons, and a bust of Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate general and the first leader of the Ku Klux Klan. We are standing at Confederate Circle, a commemorative plot commissioned in 1877. Are these flags and statues reminders of an ugly, racist past, or are they emblems of a history that we should never forget? I have trouble divorcing the heritage from the hate. Student groups in Selma have rallied to remove the Forrest statue, but the land has been managed long by the United Daughters of the Confederacy, a group that says it totally denounces any individual or group that promotes racial divisiveness or white supremacy, and only wants to honor the memory of their ancestors. As my father and I pull out of Live Oak, a woman sitting idly in a car near the monument smiles and waves at us. I notice the UDC logo is printed on her car's fuel door. The last city on our southern road trip is Montgomery, where we arrange a tour with Michelle Browder, a painter and activist who was raised in Alabama, and who I found I am more than a profit organization, or rather who founded I Am More Than, a nonprofit organization that helps young people gain entrepreneurial skills and training as tour guides. Browder is a boisterous black woman with big hair and bright red pair of cat-eye glasses. She's sharp, candid, and seemingly knows everyone in Montgomery. We climb into her golf cart, which sports a decal of her signature glasses. She takes us to the Court Square Dexter Avenue Historic District and explains that it's a hotbed of history. The Winter Building, which sits on the circle, is where the telegram calling for the strike on Fort Sumter, which triggered the Civil War, was transmitted. Rosa Parks was arrested on the opposite corner, and most jarring for me, the entire circle was once where black bodies were auctioned off during the slave trade. Browder swings her cart up Dexter Avenue near the Alabama State Capitol grounds to cut across town. As she does, we notice at least 25 men standing on the Capitol lawn. Long-haired and dressed in leather, they each carry Confederate and Alabama state flags. A man declares through a bullhorn that his right to carry guns shouldn't be hindered by liberals. Then we look to our right and see a party of people dressed in traditional Civil War-era clothing filling the lawn of the first White House of the Confederacy, which served as the executive residence of President Jefferson Davis when Montgomery was the capital of the Confederate States of America. It's at least 85 degrees outside, and men are in three-piece suits and top hats. Women wear big hoop skirts and intricate lace blouses. The scene is surreal. Sandwiched by both gatherings, I feel torn between past and present. Browder turns to us. I'm embarrassed, she says. All afternoon she'd been showing us around her city, telling us how far they had come. The newly renovated retail and community space in the once-segregated Crest department store. The work Brian Stevenson is doing at the Equal Justice Initiative, headquartered in downtown Montgomery. Real progress, often complicated. I think I know what makes us feel better, Browder says, restarting her cart. We putter wordlessly across the few avenues and stop at the Malden Brothers Barbershop, where Martin Luther King Jr. regularly had his hair cut. The space is quiet, save for the hum of the clippers. The wood-paneled walls are cluttered with pictures of King and the many other notable individuals who've had their hair cut here. There are posters from President Barack Obama's 2008 campaign beside a vintage colored waiting room sign. How y'all doing this afternoon? The barber asks us, dusting away stray hairs from the neck of his client with a soft brush. The familiarity of the place eases the disquiet of moments before. I'm not sure how to answer, so I nod and say, doing all right. The road trip has been a seesaw of the familiar and the strange. The Civil Rights Trail is a powerful testimony to the legacy of my people's perseverance. It says to those who fought and continue to fight injustice, I see you. I respect you. I affirm you. But if this journey has taught me anything other than I really like hush puppies and sweet tea, it's that in America, it's possible to feel wholly at home and yet strangely removed at the same time. As my father and I head back north, I remember something a woman I met at Selma's Brown Chapel said, lamenting the decline in church membership. A lot of young people have moved to bigger cities for work, and they just aren't interested in coming, she said. We wish they knew this was a place for them. Perhaps things would be better if they did. In her words, I hear a message that extends beyond the church and beyond Alabama. The message is partly an open invitation. When you journey into the past, you gain a glimpse into the future. Make it better. And by the way, Glenn Pogue is at work on a collection of essays on ethnicity, class, identity, and traveling while black, and a couple of travel points if you'd like to learn from the past. The U.S. Civil Rights Trail groups more than 100 sites in 14 states associated with the Civil Rights era, and they have some key sites in Alabama. And for information on all the sites, you can check it out at the CivilRightsTrail.com website. That's CivilRightsTrail.com website. And just lots of places along these trails that will give you an idea of some places to see if you'd like to follow some or all of the trail in your travels. Well, that's going to bring us to the end of today's journey. And I'm Mike Edwards, and I hope you enjoyed your journey today as we recognize Black History Month. I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our broadcast readily available as a podcast at the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.